27, 2003, and going to go a little bit out of order from the agenda. We'll look to probably have the public hearing on HCR 29 at the end of our, towards the end of our hearing today. And we will start first with HCR 3 and then go to HR 1 and then return back to the schedule of the work sessions on HCR 4 and 5. So with that, oh, and then we also have another work session just on introduction of the Legislative Council draft as a committee bill. So with that, then, let's open up a public hearing on HCR 3 and ask Representative Gilman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, George Gilman, District 55. I used to live in Central Point, now I live just out in Medford, and Kip Lombard never represented me, but he was a large influence on my very early political endeavors. And just a wonderful person. I don't think any of you probably had the pleasure of meeting him while he served in this body, but he also lobbied then for water issues several years after that, and you may have run on to him that way. He has a pretty serious medical condition, and that's the reason why I'd like to expedite this. It's a very good concurrent resolution, and we may get it passed before his death. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a question, but I'd like to make a comment to the representative. In reading his bio here, I was very impressed with his background, but what really impressed me was that he was an Eagle Scout, but he had three Eagle Scout sons. Many of us don't have that much influence over our children, and I have to say that in itself gives me pause.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. John Watt. Bring the whole crew. Okay, I was going to have them up next, but that's fine. Roger Martin and Dave Barrows. Gary Wilhelms.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is kind of a show of solidarity, perhaps, to honor someone that we have a great deal of admiration for. I come to you today speaking with two hats. First of all, on behalf of the requester of the bill, Mr. Jim Wright, who was a schoolmate of Kip's. So they go back a good long ways, and as Kip, they were best friends and worked in the community and lived in Ashland together. But as Kip began to face his challenge with the cancer that devastated him, Jim would take time every Thursday and go visit with Kip, and it's been a heart-wrenching kind of a story. With my other hat on, I had the honor to serve in this body from 1991 until 1999, and so while I didn't get to serve with Kip, I got the expertise that he brought in water issues, and I believe that you all know how important those kinds of people can be, and certainly Kip was of great help to me. I got an opportunity through that relationship to know his family and know Kip a little bit better. And I think anyone that talks about Kip will say he's one of the truly nice people that you're ever going to meet. Truly someone who cared about what he did, about his family, but certainly about this process. It goes without saying he cared about Oregon, because all of us who have the honor to serve in this body care about Oregon, but he really cared about the process. So as we sit here today and memorialize him or remember him, I hope that we can all support this concurrent resolution. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Roger Martin, and I had the honor of serving with KIPP in the 1970s. I was a minority leader in 1975 and 77. KIPP served for a number of years, always in the minority, but every single person here would have liked him very much. He was not a partisan. He was a Republican, but he had issues far beyond partisan issues. He was very successful as a legislator getting things passed. And I say was because Gary and I have both talked to Bernadette, his wife, this morning, and as we speak, he's expiring. So probably we need to amend at the end to say in memorial. But I first talked to KIPP last November when he was suffering and he was going downhill at the time. And I invited him to come to a special function we had for those that had, here in the Capitol in early December, for those that had served during the 1970s and earlier. He couldn't come. He said he just wasn't up to it, couldn't get out of bed to do that. By mid-December, he was almost in a coma and under heavy sedation. And then Bernadette got him to stop taking the medicine he was taking, and 1,000 people signed up to pray for him. Now, you can doubt that prayer has any effect, but for the next 3 months, he made an amazing recovery. And Bernadette said this morning they had a wonderful last 3 months together. By early February, he was asking me how things were going at the legislature. He wanted to know what was going on. He's a politician through and through, and he wanted to know all about it. Truly one of the remarkable individuals that I've ever had the honor to serve with and to be with. I've known KIPP for 40 years. You'll never meet a nicer guy.
I can't do it. And I don't blame you. Previous speakers have said it, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Dave Barrows. I never served with KIPP because I've never served, but I certainly knew him well. We were very good personal friends. One of my fondest memories of Representative Verger is he would bring one or more of his little boys then down for pancakes in the morning at the Capitol Coffee Shop, and we'd often, one or more of us would eat with KIPP and one or two or three of his sons. And so we got to watch the boys grow up, and that was a great treat. And they were wonderful young men, as you would expect, going on to become all three of them Eagle Scouts. I've been in this building 48 years, and KIPP would make my top 10 list of really nice people and effective, especially as a minority member his entire career. He just had one of those great qualities of personal connection with people. And the last thing I'll say is committee chairs fought to get him on their committees, which to me is about as high a compliment as you can pay to a member, because they would go to the speaker and fight for him, just as a minority member. Great guy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. That's all of our testimony. We will close the public hearing and enter a work session on HCR 3. Your motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that HCR 3 be adopted.
Mm-hmm.
And move to the floor.
Okay. Representative Flores has moved the adoption of HCR 3 to the floor. Any discussion?
Would it help if I would have said I can't do it?
Okay. No discussion. Let's call the roll.
Representative Backman?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Excused.
Representative
Close? Excused.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Moore?
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
Aye. And we'll have Representative Gilman be the carrier. Okay. And let's seeing Representative Butler here. Let's move forward then to open a public hearing on HCR 4. Representative Nolan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mary Nolan, State Representative from Southwest Portland. I'm appearing before your committee today as co-chief sponsor with Senator Hannon of House Concurrent Resolution 4, which honors Oregon's 31st governor, Bob Straub, who, as you know, died last November. Bob Straub embodied the very best of the state he served as governor, treasurer, state senator, and county commissioner. He was a rangy, private, and unassuming man who was also a bold and creative leader. He left a remarkable legacy and is remembered warmly by all who were privileged to know him. Bob Straub was perhaps among Oregon's most innovative treasurers, transforming the stewardship of state funds during his tenure, 1965 to 1972, and introducing modern business and investment practices. Serving as governor from 1975 to 79, he led an effort that reduced the unemployment rate from 12% to 5%, while at the same time increasing direct property tax relief and initiating utility rate relief for seniors. Perhaps we could follow some of his lessons as we face some of those same challenges in this session. As chief executive of the state, he appointed more women, minorities, and persons with disabilities to top government positions than any of his predecessors. Under his leadership, more than 50 firms were recruited to come to Oregon. He compiled an impressive record as a defender of Oregon's beaches and helped redirect funding away from the Mount Hood Freeway into public transit. Bob Straub was a graduate of Dartmouth College, and a few years after he was there, I followed him to that university, and then later followed him back to Oregon. I am proud to share these connections with this builder, developer, farmer, rancher, family man, and public servant. The resolution before you recognizes his distinguished career, remarkable legacy, and significant accomplishments, and conveys the condolences of the Legislative Assembly to his family. I will bring your attention to an error that we found in some of the information we used to draft the resolution, and would ask, I believe, Mr. Chair, you have a -1 amendment that corrects a factual error in the resolution, and I would urge you to amend it before you send it to the floor. I thank you for your attention.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Thank you, Representative. Michael Tully.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Michael Tully. I'm a resident of Representative Nolan's district in Southwest Portland and a member of her staff. I'm honored to have been asked by Senate President Pro Tem Len Hannon to read a statement. Senator Hannon, as Representative Nolan mentioned, is the chief Senate sponsor of the resolution. I regret that I am unable to be present to speak to you about the great and unassuming man that is recognized by HCR 4. In the 144-year history of our great state, only 35 men and one woman have been honored by their fellow citizens by being elected to the office of governor. One of those men was Bob Straub. He took office as Oregon's 31st governor on January 13, 1975, the same day on which I began my service as a member of the state Senate. I'm honored to be the chief co-sponsor of the resolution that acknowledges the many accomplishments of this giant of a man, and pleased that each of my Senate colleagues has added their name as a sponsor. When his family, friends, staff, contemporaries, and ordinary citizens gathered at the Capitol last December to remember the man who did so much for this state, his fellow governors, past, present, and soon to be, spoke of the Bob Straub they knew. Mark Hatfield called him an uncommon man with a fierce commitment to the common good. Victor Atiyah recalled that Bob Straub was a doer, not a talker. In his vision for Oregon, he knew what needed to be done, and he just went about doing it. Neil Goldschmidt said, "He loved this land, Oregon, like no other Oregonian I have ever known." Barbara Roberts remembered him as a man of the land and acknowledged his unwavering dedication to make certain that Oregon's citizens owned the state's beaches. John Kitzhaber spoke of a really great man whose love for Oregon was reflected in his governorship and in his personal life. Ted Kulongowski listed characteristics that he believed described Bob Straub: independent, intelligent, honest, a dreamer, opinionated, at times an agitator. He could be argumentative. He was a humanitarian, a public servant, and a conservationist, and a very, very funny man. This is the man that House Concurrent Resolution 4 honors, Robert William Straub. In my 28 years here, I can think of no person more deserving of this recognition. I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Dave Barrows.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't often testify on behalf of these kinds of resolutions, but I did feel very compelled today to come and talk both about Kip Lombard and about Governor Straub, and I'll be very brief. First week of this session, Representative Gordon Anderson asked me, he said, "In your 48 years, Dave, who is the funniest governor you ever served under?" And I said, I'm going to pass on that because none of them were very funny. But I'm going to change your question around, and I'm going to tell you who I think the two most underappreciated. I mean, I go back to Paul Patterson, a governor none of you have ever heard of. But I'm going to tell you the two that I think were the most underappreciated. One was Vic Atiyah, and the other was Bob Straub. And Michael's speech from Senator Hannon says it all. The comments that were made at the service said it all. He was a very extraordinary individual. And but if you ask people who were the two or three great governors of this state, Bob Straub's name wouldn't come to most people's mind. And frankly, I think they should. At least I can't say all, because as old as I am, I'm going to go back 48 years. But he was a dandy, and I'm pleased that this legislature is honoring him. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. No further testimony on this resolution, so we will close the public hearing and open a work session on HCR 4. If we can move adoption of the dash one.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the dash one amendment to HCR 4.
Okay. Representative Forrest has moved adoption of the dash one amendment to HCR 4. Any discussion? Any objection? So adopted. And
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of HCR 4 as adopted and
as amended
and to be passed to the floor.
Okay. Representative Forrest has moved adoption of HCR 4 as amended, moved to the floor. And any discussion? Okay, let's call the roll.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
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 Aye. So adopted, and have Representative Nolan carry that. And we will close the work session on HCR 4 and open up a public hearing on HR 1. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Tom Butler from House District 60. I'm bringing you today House Resolution Number 1, which basically expresses the support for the Vancouver, British Columbia to be selected as the host for the 2010 Winter Olympic Games. I just give you by way of reference the benefits to the western states that we had in hosting the 2002 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City, we received some no small amount of carryover from that at our ski slopes in Boise, Idaho, and in Eastern Oregon. And we have every reason to believe if British Columbia, Whistler, B.C., is selected as the host site for the 2010 Winter Olympics, that we will see a great deal of financial benefit and economic well-being that will be passed on to the ski slopes in the state of Oregon as a result of world-class skiing events being held here in the Northwest, and encourage your support and passage of House Resolution 1.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions, Representative Butler? Okay, seeing none. Thank you very much. So without further testimony and no one else has signed up, we will close the public hearing on H.R. 1 and open up a work session on H.R. 1. Representative Flores?
I get to do it. Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of H.R. 1 and passage to the floor.
Okay. Representative Flores has moved adoption of House Resolution 1 to move to the floor. Any discussion? Okay. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. And motion passes, and we will ask Representative Butler to carry that. Thank you very much. And we'll close the work session on H.R. 1 and now open up a public hearing on H.C.R. 5. And we have a combined statement from Bruce Fitzwater, Jane Glasser, and Gwen Whitmore.
Bruce Fitzwater from the Portland area.
Gwen Whitmore from the Portland area.
Jane Glasser, also from the Portland area.
Okay, welcome. Do you have a statement?
Yes. Gwen is a English teacher at Benson High School, and we'll have her read it. Just take a minute.
Okay, very good.
Chairman Doyle and committee members, March is designated as National Women's History Month. It is a time when schools and other organizations acquaint themselves with women who have played significant roles in the history of our country. Mary Baker Eddy was one of these women. Born in 1821 on a small farm in New England, she spent much of the first half of her life in poverty and ill health. Yet when she passed on in 1910, she was one of the best known and noted women in America. One remarkable aspect of her achievement was that she did not begin to advance until she was middle-aged, and then this advancement was done without a well-connected marriage or outside wealth. She progressed on the strength of her ability as an author, leader, and significantly, her wisdom in public affairs. Recently, there have been several new biographies responding to the growing interest in Eddy. Why should we be interested in her here in Oregon? Historically, Oregon has gained much of its culture through the western expansion of the United States, particularly in the latter half of the 19th century. Eddy's ideas, achievements, and accomplishments influenced individuals, both men and women, in Oregon, and these ideas still influence people today. In 1908, Mary Baker Eddy founded the Christian Science Monitor, the first nationally distributed American newspaper against a media background that spawned the term yellow journalism. Today, Oregonians who do not subscribe to the Monitor directly receive some of their news through the Monitor's news services. For instance, in the Oregonian lately, there have been extensive articles on Iraq from the Christian Science Monitor. Also, broadcast interviews with the Monitor reporters through National Public Radio are frequently aired.
There is a particular reason to support this resolution now. A touring exhibit on the life and work of Mary Baker Eddy, which was developed in conjunction with the United States Women's Rights National Historical Park in Seneca Falls, New York, is now being shown in Oregon. After its display at the park itself, the exhibit has been touring various states, and this spring and summer, it is at some Oregon public libraries. In February, the exhibit was hosted by the Klamath Falls Public Library, and right now, in March and April, it is at the University of Oregon's Knight Library, and during May and June, it will be at the Salem Public Library. In July, the exhibit will be in Boise at the Idaho State Capitol Building, and during August and September, it returns to libraries in the Portland area. 2 weeks ago, at the March 13th opening ceremony for the exhibit at Knight Library at the University of Oregon, the program brochure characterized the touring exhibit as an interactive exhibit which, and I quote, highlights the compelling story of the 19th century of a 19th century woman who rose above personal battles with illness and society's restrictions on women to become a noted author, healer, teacher, publisher, and founder of the Christian Science Monitor at age 87, end quote. In supporting this resolution, you would be affirming House Concurrent Resolution 458, agreed to on September 25, 2002, by the United States House of Representatives, which concludes, resolved by the House of Representatives, the Senate concurring, that the Congress recognizes and commends Mary Baker Eddy for her outstanding achievements and contributions, particularly her contributions to the advancements of women's rights as a public figure and role model in the early stages of the women's rights movement. Eddy's contribution to women's rights has received similar acknowledgement from a number of states, including her birth state in New Hampshire, the states of Massachusetts and Rhode Island, where she lived for a time, and also Illinois, Texas, Oklahoma, California, as well as numerous cities, towns, and federal office holders. We ask you to support this resolution as a supporter of a greater awareness of our collective history and of those who have pioneered the rights that we all enjoy today. Thank you, Chairman Doyle.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you for your testimony. And no one else signed up to testify on this bill, so we will close the public hearing on HCR 5 and open a work session on HCR 5. We can get a motion to adopt.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt House Concurrent Resolution 5 and move it to the floor.
Okay. Representative Flores has moved adoption of HCR 5 to move to the floor. Any discussion? Seeing none, let's call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. So that passes, and we will ask Representative Crummell to carry that, and we close the public or the work session on HCR 5. And now, committee, let's just do a quick bill introduction here, if we could, on LC 3540. And we need a motion to introduce LC 3540 as a committee bill.
Mr. Chair, I move that we introduce LC 3540 as a committee bill.
Thank you. Representative Flores has moved that we introduce LC 3540 as a committee bill. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Any objection? Seeing none? Be it up. Introduced. And okay, we then we'll close that work session and now open up a public hearing on HJR 29. Representative Richardson.
Yes,
right behind you.
Good.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dennis Richardson, State Representative for District 4, and the chief sponsor for House Joint Resolution 29. By way of background, and by the way, I'm here with Ted
Ritlinger,
excuse me, who from LC's office and has a lot of background and additional information. I'd like to begin, though, by giving just a little bit of background to the committee as to what the basis is for HJR 29. And we all know that in the federal government there's three branches of government, and that since the very beginning there's been tension between them. One of the first major cases by the American, the federal Supreme Court was Marbury versus Madison, where the Chief Justice determined that, and although it wasn't in the Constitution, they determined that the judiciary would have final say on constitutionality and therefore had tremendous power and control over the executive and judiciary branches, I mean the legislative branches. And then through the years there's been pressure and tension between the judiciary and the executive. We know that when President Roosevelt was president, he was going to pack the court because he didn't like the results that he was getting. And then there was the judiciary's response to the Watergate tapes. There's been tension between the legislative and the executive and the post-Vietnam War Powers Act and others. Well, there's always that tension, and that's good because it's part of checks and balances as long as the balance remains. But in Oregon, we have four branches of government because we have in the Constitution the initiative process. And so essentially in Oregon, we have the people as an additional branch of government, plus the judiciary, the legislature, and the executive. And that has worked well over the years until the late 90s, when there became an imbalance in power, when the judiciary made a decision that interpreted the Oregon Constitution in such a way that procedurally the right of the people to pass their initiatives and have their voices heard in the Constitution of this state has essentially been turned over to the control of the judiciary. And so the people passed Measure 40 and they passed Measure A. They passed different measures, and appellate courts have picked up on this as well. And although the people had their voices heard because they passed the initiative, the courts have said because of the way the initiative may have been worded on a procedural basis, the initiative is going to be thrown out. And so now the power of the people, this first branch of Oregon government, has been grossly reduced. Now, the purpose of HJR 29 is to restore to the people that power that they have to have their voices heard through the initiative. Basically, I can give you a sentence from the Oregon Constitution, which is Article 17, Verse 1. It says, when two or more amendments to the Constitution shall be submitted in the manner aforesaid in this section to the voters of this state at the same election, they shall be so submitted that each amendment shall be voted on separately. And so what we have is the court now feeling duty bound to look at each initiative, and if they see any significant difference between how this initiative is going to affect different laws or different subjects, they're saying that that will no longer be allowed to be added to the Constitution, and so the voice of the people will not be heard. So HJR 29 basically changes one sentence in the Constitution, and it says the following: notwithstanding Section 1 of this article, which is Article 17, the requirement that each amendment to this Constitution be submitted so that each amendment shall be voted on separately does not apply to proposed initiative amendments to this Constitution submitted under Article 1 or Section 1, Article 4 of the Constitution, which is the article that says that the people have a right to initiatives in this state. So the purpose of this HJR 29 is to restore to the people the right that they've had from the day that our Constitution was signed to have an influence on what takes place in this state through the initiative process. And we would hope that you would support this opportunity to restore the will of the people to the people.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. Are there any questions? thank you for your testimony.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ted Reutlinger from the Legislative Council's office. And Representative Richardson asked me to provide you a little bit of basic background and context for this resolution. An important thing to know is that there are basically two ways to amend the Oregon Constitution under the provisions of the Oregon Constitution. The first is Article 4, Section 1, which allows initiative amendments to the Constitution. And the second part is Article 17, which generally refers to legislative referrals of amendments to the Constitution. And there's a host of different requirements for each one of those. For initiative amendments, you have to comply with the single subject requirement, as well as the separate vote requirement that's in Article 17. For legislative referrals, you only have to comply with the separate vote requirement in Article 17. And all of this flowed out of the main case, which is Armada versus Kitzhaber, which is the case in 1998 where the Supreme Court ruled that the victims' rights constitutional initiative measure was invalid because it contained more than one amendment to the Constitution. That's the case where the court applied this separate amendment provision back to initiative amendments. And they came up with a test, but basically the test is that a measure will fail if it contains more than two or more amendments to the Constitution, if they're substantive in nature, and if they're not closely related. And then the court gets into a test about how they determine whether or not a proposed amendment is in fact closely related. And they look at the Constitution, and they look at the changes, and it becomes relatively complicated. To date, the court has struck down several statewide initiative measures under the separate vote requirement. They include the crime victims' rights, term limits, the Open and Fair Elections Act, and ballot measure 7 on compensating private property owners for takings. Ultimately, what this will do is exactly what Representative Richardson said, is remove the application of the single amendment requirement to initiative petitions. What you'd end up with is for initiative amendments to the Constitution, those petitions would have to satisfy the single subject requirement, which is much broader than the separate amendment requirement. The legislative referred amendments to the Constitution would still be subject to this separate amendment requirement. It's relatively complicated, but that in simple terms is what it does.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Mona Sanderson?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Would you please tell me again which measures then were passed by the voters and then were struck down because of the Armada?
So far, according to my research, and I hope that I haven't missed any, the crime victims' rights measure, which was ballot measure 40, which was struck down in Armada in 1998, the term limits provisions, which had applied term limits to legislative and statewide offices, that was struck down in Lehman versus Bradbury in January of 2002. The Open and Fair Elections Act, which was a series of campaign finance and initiative provisions, which was ballot measure 62, struck down in April of 2002. And ballot measure 7, which was the property taking compensation measure, struck down in October of 2002.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Oops, sorry. Thank you. Thank you for your consideration.
Let's bring up David Bedanke.
Actually, I do.
Do you want to ask?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mr. Reitlinger, if you can hold up for, I think there's another question for you. Do you want to ask now?
Yeah.
Okay, why don't you come on back. Sorry about that, David.
Sorry, I didn't think of the questions soon enough. Thank you for coming back. Could you tell me, just explain, maybe take one of those that then actually was armada'd out. Did it affect certain, what made it, what ramification did it actually have on the state where it dealt with? Let's just choose the crime victims one. Why was that then struck down? I mean, why it didn't pass?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Ted Reilinger, Legislative Council again. Mr. Chair, Representative Myers Anderson, what the court did was set forth a test that it uses, that basically it can plug any measure that comes along into the test. And the test is, does it involve two or more amendments to the Constitution? And for each one of these measures, for the crime victims' rights measure, for example, the court said, yes, it does. It changes the Constitution in two or more ways. Then they look at whether or not those changes were substantive or just minor technical things. And in each case, they said, yes, those are substantive changes. Then they get to the more interesting part, which is, are those changes closely related? And what they do is engage at that point in another two-part test. First, they look at the sections of the Constitution which the measure would actually change. And those can be explicit changes which are actually contained in the measure, or they can be implicit changes, changes that occur without actually amending a section of the Constitution. So they look at what does it do to the Constitution now, and if they determined that the sections that it amends are not closely related at all, then the measure is in trouble. But if they find some sort of close relation between the sections that are amended, then they go to the next step, which is, are the changes themselves closely related? And in each case, it's going to be a case-by-case determination about whether or not the changes are related. And with each one of these measures that has been struck down, they've either determined that the sections in the Constitution that were amended were not closely related, or the changes themselves were not closely related. In the campaign finance measure, for example, they said that, well, there's a provision in there about paid petitioners, and there is a provision in there about qualifications for candidates or something, and said that the fact that you've got a candidate provision over here and something related to initiative petitions here, those are not closely related, therefore it's more than one amendment and it's invalid. That's the basic methodology that they've adopted and use for each one of these cases.
I just follow up. How many amendments do we have in the Constitution? Hundreds?
Ms. Chair, Representative Anderson, in the Constitution itself now are sections of existing law. When you propose to amend the Constitution, you are offering amendments to the document, which you can do by actually amending existing sections or proposing entirely new sections. But yeah, the Constitution for the state of Oregon is about half of this book, so it's a relatively large document.
Thank you. Any further? Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, but a comment. It is certainly much easier and, frankly, a better read to read the United States Constitution than to look at the Oregon Constitution for any number of reasons, I guess.
Okay. Any further? Thank you, Mr. Reilinger. Okay. Mr. Podanke?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Podanke, Executive Director of the ACLU of Oregon, testifying in opposition to HR 29. Mr. Chair, I'm going to try and keep this simple. As I believe you know, I am not a lawyer. I have worked for the ACLU since 1982, and in that capacity been involved in many initiative campaigns, both in support of initiatives and in opposition to initiatives. The challenge to ballot measure 40 was an ACLU case handled by one of our volunteer attorneys. We have also been involved in several of the other cases that have gone up. In particular, we brought the challenge against ballot measure 62, which was the measure that Mr. Redlinger referred to as the Open and Fair Elections Act. And I think it's important to note that that was a measure that was proposed by public employee unions in response to the efforts of Bill Sizemore and others to limit payroll deductions for political activity. On the same election where Measure 62 was on the ballot, there was a proposal by Mr. Sizemore that would have prohibited political dues deductions for public employees. And buried inside of ballot measure 62, along with a number of changes to campaign finance regulations, was a provision that would have guaranteed public employees the right to have payroll deductions for political purposes. Although we opposed Mr. Sizemore's initiative, we also opposed ballot measure 62 put forward by the public employee unions, because we believe it is critically important for voters to be able to understand the impact of amendments to the Constitution that they are voting on in their ballots. And that is the principal reason for the multiple amendment rule. For the separate vote requirement. It is so that voters who must approve any amendment to the Oregon Constitution can make sense of what are sometimes very complicated measures that are put before them, and in recent years, so that they can make sense of very complicated measures that are purposely written to be confusing to voters or to hide what the primary purpose of the proponents is. With regard to ballot measure 40, it was, that's the so-called victims' rights measure, and I know that Steve Dole, one of the drafters of that measure, is here today, and I expect he'll probably testify. That measure had many impacts. It was a very sweeping measure, and Representative Mons Anderson, you asked which sections of the Constitution it affected. If you looked at the Oregon Bill of Rights provisions related to criminal prosecutions, it affected most of those. In addition, it had a provision that essentially repealed two provisions of the Oregon Bill of Rights in criminal cases, Article 1, Section 9, which is the Oregon Search and Seizure Clause, and Article 1, Section 12, which is the provision that prohibits double jeopardy and self-incrimination. That provision, which was very far down in ballot measure 40, essentially would have required Oregon courts to interpret those provisions in line with the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of the federal Constitution. But there were many other changes that were made by ballot measure 40. It changed the right of a defendant to a trial by jury. It changed the right of criminal defendants to release on bail pending their trial. And I won't go through all the different provisions, but after the decision came down in Armada versus Kitzhaber, which overturned ballot measure 40, the legislature split up ballot measure 40 into 8 different joint resolutions. 7 of those resolutions made it through the legislative process and were placed on the ballot for a special election in November of 1999. And I think the wisdom of the separate vote requirement is very well illustrated by that process, because that one amendment I referred to that would have essentially repealed two provisions of the Oregon Bill of Rights in criminal cases was rejected by the legislature when they looked at it as a standalone option. Of the other 7 resolutions that were placed on the ballot and became ballot measures 69, 70, 71, 72, 73, 74 and 75, the voters approved four of those measures and rejected three. So when the voters had the opportunity to look at those issues separately, as the Constitution required, they had the wisdom to pick and choose between them. When it was all bundled together in one package, the voters didn't see past the slogan of Ballot Measure 40, which was to create rights for crime victims. One of those seven measures was a measure that related directly to the rights of crime victims. The rest of the measures took away rights from criminal defendants or affected the jury selection and other provisions of the Oregon Bill of Rights. So we believe this, the multiple amendment rule or the separate vote requirement, is a very important protection for all Oregonians to make sure that we know what we're voting on when we're asked to amend the core fundamental document of our system of government in this state. And finally, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to comment on a statement that was made by Representative Richardson. He described the initiative and referendum process as a fourth branch of government. I don't think that was quite accurate, because Article 4 of the Oregon Constitution says very clearly that the right of initiative and referendum is a legislative branch power, that the legislative power shall be shared by the legislature and by the people through the initiative process. So we do still have three branches of government, even though the initiative and referendum process is a very important part of that. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Moss Anderson.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to know if you feel that any initiative that would come before the voters should first be checked out by the judicial branch or by the legislative branch before it goes on the ballot.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moss Anderson, we have supported prior review of initiatives for meeting these procedural requirements until we prevailed in the case involving Ballot Measure 40. It was the Attorney General's position that they had no power to do any pre-election review of initiatives. The Oregon Supreme Court has made very clear that they will not review the substantive constitutionality of a proposed initiative pre-election. And in part, that's to try to avoid too many lawsuits while a measure is pending before the voters. We have tried on numerous occasions to try to get the courts to rule on the procedural requirements of a proposal pre-election. We generally have not been successful in being able to get those rulings made, at least by the appellate courts, prior to those measures being voted on if they make the ballot. Most of the measures have failed to qualify, so the cases have become moot. But since the decision in Armada versus Kitsap of the Measure 40 case, the Attorney General's office does, the Secretary of State, under the advice of the Attorney General, does review initiatives for compliance with the procedural requirements, at least for a single subject and the multiple amendment rule. And a number of draft initiatives have been rejected by the Attorney General in recent years on the basis of the multiple amendment laws. If a proposed initiative is rejected by the Secretary of State, the proponents of that initiative, the chief petitioners, can go into court and challenge that decision, as they could challenge any elected official's decision. But we would strongly support making sure that those decisions can be reviewed in an expedited fashion. we believe it's much better for these constitutional issues to be ironed out before a measure reaches the ballot, because there is an assumption on the part of voters that if a measure has gotten that far, it'll be put into effect if they approve it. And unfortunately, the courts have been very reluctant to do that kind of review ahead of time, as has the Attorney General, until they've been told by the courts that they must do that.
Any other questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir. Kathy Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the government chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I apologize for not having written testimony. Unfortunately, I did take a day of vacation yesterday and did not get the posting of HGI 29. But I do want to make a couple of comments, and then I will submit to you a more formal report for your perusal. The League wants to be on record as opposing HJR 29. We stand in agreement with much of what Mr. Fedenke has said. Just one other comment. In most of the organizations to which I belong and with which the League coalesces, there is what we call parliamentary procedure. And when we are amending our bylaws or the constitution of whatever these organizations are, it is very rarely that we do amendments as a whole. If we attempt to do that, there is usually a motion that asks that they be separated so that members can vote on them singly, because not everyone is in agreement with a whole group of amendments that are put together collectively. It just makes sense, and you have a better understanding of what the impact is upon your body of rule, the framework of your state government, such as the Constitution, in order to look at each of these things as an important separate resolution. So we believe that simply bundling them all together, it's not a good idea, and I will, as I said, I would submit to you a more formal report about that, but we do stand in opposition to this. We do not feel it is good public policy. Thank you.
Questions? Okay, thank you. Margaret Olney?
Thank you very much, Chairman Doyle and members of this committee. My name is Margaret Olney, and I'm an attorney from Portland, Oregon. The law firm is Smith, Gamson, Diamond, and Olney. And a significant portion of my practice concerns involves election law, and I specifically focus on issues involving initiatives from the ballot title process through the election and also I've been involved in challenges. And I'm here today to speak against House Joint Resolution 29. First, I'd like to offer a bit of background. I think it is interesting in light of the testimony that we've heard today. In 1902 is when the initiative process was overwhelmingly approved by a constitutional amendment, and that was how it was established. That's in 1902. We were the third state in the nation to adopt the initiative process. Then in 1906, one of the earliest initiatives, proposals to amend the Constitution, dealt with the process of amending the Constitution itself. And that is an initiative to put into place in the Oregon Constitution the prohibition about putting multiple amendments to the voters in a single initiative. And that language, again, as we have heard, is when two or more amendments shall be submitted in the manner aforesaid to the voters of the state at the same election, they shall be so submitted that each amendment shall be voted on separately. I'd like to note that that applies to both initiatives that are put on the ballot by the people and also by legislative referrals. This has become known as the separate vote requirement, and this is what HJR 29 proposes to eliminate. Here's why I think it's a bad idea. First, there's emphasis that the separate vote requirement applies only to our amendments to our Constitution. It doesn't apply to all initiatives. So when we hear talk about protecting the initiative process, we need to remember that this only deals with initiatives that seek to amend and place multiple amendments on the Oregon Constitution. Initiatives to pass laws, the bottle bill, other initiatives that are statutory, are not subject to the exacting scrutiny of the separate amendment provision. Rather, they simply have to comply with the single subject requirement, which is the same requirement that applies to legislation that's passed out of this body. And that standard is one that is quite broad. If there is any kind of coherent theme between in the proposal, in the initiative, it will pass a single subject requirement. And that might be fine for an initiative that is submitted by that is a statutory proposal, essentially, because it can be fixed by the legislature, you know, if there are problems, or it can be considered. But where we're talking about amendments to the Constitution, I think it's a very different story. The Constitution, as Representative Backlund had noted, and the U.S. Constitution is nice and brief. I mean, the notion is it's a fundamental document for how we govern ourselves in our state, and it's the most important statement of law and principles. Unfortunately, the Oregon Constitution as a reality includes the Bill of Rights, the Oregon Bill of Rights, which is much more akin to the U.S. Constitution. And then it has a whole lot of other very detailed, mundane specifics that we typically don't think of as belonging in the Oregon Constitution. When voters are asked to do something as serious as amending the Constitution, they should be presented with a single and focused choice to make, and that's what the separate vote requirement ensures. You know, it prohibits a Christmas tree initiative which has something underneath it for everyone. Ballot Measure 62, which was the proposal that Dave Fedenke referred to, I think is a good example of that. That it was a proposal which complied with the single subject requirement. It all dealt with campaign finance legislative kind of practice. But there were a variety of different initiatives in that, different changes to the Constitution, different provisions, and the court struck it down. If this bill were to pass, that kind of political maneuvering that strategy is invited in response to other initiatives that might be on the ballot. The other good example, as Dave Fedenke pointed out, is Measure 40, which the legislature referred out in 7 separate amendments, of which only 4 passed and 3 were rejected. There's a clear example that when voters were asked specifically to amend the Constitution in a particular regard that was narrowly focused and specific, they made a different choice than would have been given if all 7 were allowed to be log rolled into one initiative. It also bears emphasis that the separate vote requirement crosses the political spectrum. We have, I would agree with Legislative Council, that to date there have been 4 initiatives that have been struck down based on the separate vote requirement. And they include the campaign finance reform of Ballot Measure 62, which was proposed by labor unions, the crime victims' right proposal, Measure 40, which was under Armada, Measure 7, and the term limits. And those certainly, represent a broad range of political choices. So this is about good policy and what we need to do to protect the integrity of the initiative process as opposed to politics.
Question? I assume only 4. How many total initiatives have we passed then? I mean, ballpark. Over 100? 50 and 4 then have. I was just trying to get a sense.
What is the volume? I'm trying to check in any given year. I mean, certainly since 1906, it's been a lot of them. I can't answer that question.
Just something curious that I'd like to know. How many initiatives have been proposed, how many have passed, and then we've had 4 that have been overturned.
Right.
Okay.
I would also like to address your concern and Representative Anderson about when in the process these issues should be raised. Because one of the problems that does come up is if people vote for an initiative, they think it passes constitutional muster, and then they're frustrated. They feel like their vote is thwarted by the courts, whose role is to review those initiatives, those bills, to scrutinize them just as they do the bills that are passed out of this legislature. And the process is currently set up where the Secretary of State is required to review any initiative, determine whether or not it has a single subject or a separate vote requirement, and then that can be challenged ahead of time, either by the people who think it does violate separate vote or those who think it doesn't violate separate vote. So there is a process already in place to enable that review. Now, timeliness can certainly be a problem in different cases, but it is there. Again, I would note that the current Constitution doesn't prevent or inhibit anyone from placing their ideas on the initiative. They just have to craft their initiatives in a way that they present only a single amendment. So to talk about this as taking away the right of the people is inaccurate, because the people do have the right to put to the vote single amendments to the Constitution at one time. And some, I ask this committee to first and foremost protect the integrity of our Constitution, which is what this initiative is about. The voters of Oregon wisely chose to put the separate vote limitation into the Constitution in 1906. It helps insulate our most basic document from the fads, fancies, and political manipulators of the day. The current Constitution ensures that it can be changed only by deliberate and focused consideration, and that's a valuable protection that should not be eliminated. Thank you for your opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Great. Other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Ms. Olney. To your knowledge, are there other provisions of the Constitution that may have at some point in the past been enacted which had dual provisions or multiple provisions?
That have not been challenged on that basis? I suspect there have been, yes.
And
Follow up?
And then in that regard, for instance, and I'm thinking of when the Court of Appeals was formed and Article 7 of the Constitution was in Article 7, there were numerous provisions in that particular initiative or that particular article, and yet it's not challenged as far as the Court of Appeals, and should we consider that we should strike down the Court of Appeals then if it would meet the same criteria?
I think we need to be careful about distinguishing initiatives that might deal with broad subjects with initiatives that contain multiple amendments to the Constitution. Just because it's complicated does not necessarily mean that it contains multiple amendments to the existing Constitution. In addition, the court has said that multiple amendments may pass constitutional muster if they're closely related. So if, for example, in the creation of the Court of Appeals, there are details regarding the implementation of that initiative, of that change, that don't otherwise change significant other aspects of the Constitution, then either it may not be multiple amendments to the Constitution, or whatever those multiple amendments are, they would be closely related, and not be struck down. But there are certainly initiatives that I think have been passed that would not survive the scrutiny that's been given to by the courts today.
Follow up. Then in that context, is this more of a contemporary mode of the Supreme Court to be applying this criteria as opposed to longstanding historical?
Chairman Dill and Representative Flores, I would say that if you read the Armada decision itself, the Supreme Court spends many, many pages reviewing the historical development of the single subject and the separate vote requirement. And while the law had not evolved to the same degree, it is not a new doctrine. It is one that they looked at historical cases, and in part as the separate, the single subject requirement became one that was so diluted that really does not have a lot. It created the vacuum. I shouldn't say vacuum. That's actually not accurate. But if that the court examined the separate vote requirement and said, this is still the concern we're aiming at. We're still concerned about log rolling. And while the single subject looks at the initiative sort of outside of the Constitution, what the separate vote says is when you have an initiative that makes multiple changes to the Constitution, that's when it gets triggered. And as with any judicial doctrine, it has evolved, but it is not out of whole cloth. It's certainly based in the 1906 amendment from the Oregon voters saying that we needed to protect this initiative process from manipulation by requiring that multiple amendments be put to the voters in separate amendments and separate initiatives.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Burchard.
Yes. You know, I have become a student of Oregon history, having moved here 30-some-odd years ago, and I'm quite fascinated by some of it. One of the things that fascinated me is that we read a bill three times in the legislature before it comes before us three different times, and the reason for that is that many people, when that was put in, didn't read. So Oregonians wanted to be sure that you had an opportunity, if you could not read, that you could understand what that bill said, so they had it read three times. I think there is, all through history, an effort in Oregon to have the power of the people remain with the people, and not to change that power into the power of the government, because they personally didn't really like government. And I think the representative government made a lot of sense to them. So I think if you look at the separate vote requirement in the context of Oregon history, it is another effort to be sure that you understand exactly what that subject is and that you're voting on something. However, as you've just said, that one vote can be a very complicated issue just because it doesn't change the Constitution. It might be very complicated. So I have to differ with you a little bit that people are trying to work into the process some agenda that's hidden. I don't think that that's necessarily the case, because I think an agenda could be hidden and still put into the separate vote. Do you follow my drift there? Because I don't think that's what it is. I think what we have to be really careful for is the protection of the initiative process. I grew up in a state that didn't have it, and it is a wonderful thing. Whether it's always used as it should be used certainly is a debate and an issue that can be raised. But never, never to get rid of it. And so I haven't really thought this whole thing through to my satisfaction. But I do believe that you can complicate anything, you can hide anything, you can manipulate anything, but I don't think we should ever underestimate the power of the voter or the intelligence of people when it comes to manipulation. We all have an instinct over being taken. And so I give a lot of credit to Oregonians in that regard. And I think they have instinctively a good way of looking at a situation and knowing that it's not a good thing for them.
Thank you. Any other? All right, thank you, Ms. Long.
Thank you.
Okay, Steve Dole, Ross Shea, and Dave Honeycutt.
That was very good, John. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ross A., Director of Legal Affairs. I'll let Mr. Dole and Mr. Honeycutt speak for themselves, as they are very capable and very apt to do. I'm passing out for your review an article I co-authored with my with Kelly Clark that was authored in March of 2001 relating to the Armada decision and kind of how we got where we are today. Since the since that article was written, we've had two measures that were thrown out by the courts based upon our Armada challenge: the term limits measure and the and also measure 7. I want to start off my comments today by saying, by correcting Ms. Olney and her historical recitation of the separate vote amendment, Article 17, Section 1, and Section 2 of the Constitution. There was, and this is laid out fairly well in the Armada decision, there was a prohibition prior to 1906 contained in the Oregon Constitution which prohibited more than one amendment, but it prohibited the legislature from presenting more than one amendment or making more than one amendment to the Constitution. In 1906, obviously 4 years after the people enacted the initiative and referral, a referendum process, we had the amendment which is now codified in Article 17, Section 1 and 2 of the Constitution. The problem here that HJR 29 is trying to resolve, if you will, is the last sentence of Article 17, Section 1, which I notice no speaker yet today has mentioned. And I'll read it for you. Pretty simple. It says, "This article shall not be construed to impair the right of the people to amend this Constitution by vote upon an initiative petition, therefore." One more time. "This article shall not be construed to impair the right of the people to amend this Constitution by vote upon an initiative petition, therefore." Now that was inserted, in addition to the other language, in Article 17, Section 1. The interesting point about this, a little bit more of a history lesson here, there was three cases prior to the Armada case, which was decided in 1998, which dealt with Article 17, Section 1 as it currently stands. The first two cases were in the mid to late 30s. The last case was Baum v. Newbury, which is an interesting case because it actually challenged an initiative petition that amended the Oregon Constitution and created what is effectively now our current system of reapportionment. Now, without deciding whether or not that system violated the separate vote amendment, the Oregon Supreme Court just said, we don't need to go there, and basically punted on it. Since the Armada decision, there has been two measures that have been thrown out. There's actually been three challenges. Most people don't mention the third challenge, and most people aren't aware of the third challenge. And that was one that I brought, actually, to the Secretary of State's reapportionment plan, the Oregon Supreme Court. We argued, hey, Baum v. Newbury never answered this question. So whether or not our current system of apportionment violates separate votes. The Oregon Supreme Court said, oh, well, Baum v. Newbury really did, and even if it didn't, that amendment happens to survive Armada. So what we have, actually, is one amendment that has survived, although if it was challenged on its own and Baum didn't exist, it probably wouldn't survive. We have at least four so far that have not survived Armada challenges. There are a myriad of initiated amendments in the Oregon Constitution that would not survive an Armada challenge. Women's suffrage would not survive. Article 7 amended, which created the Court of Appeals, would not survive. I can go on and on and on. There's a prohibition from individuals serving in the legislature and receiving pay from the executive department, which would mean that President Senator Peter Courtney would not be President Peter Courtney. He'd either have to quit his job at Western Oregon University or he'd have to resign as state senator. There are a number of measures in this Constitution that simply would not survive an Armada challenge. I want to refer back to Baum briefly. Baum said, the court in Baum said, Section 1 of Article 17 does not prohibit the people from adopting an amendment which would affect more than one article or section by implication. You heard testimony today saying, well, if it affects an article implicitly, that somehow violates the separate vote requirement. That's not what the Baum court says. Then we have the Armada court coming in and effectively saying, well, maybe, maybe not. The implication language, just to clarify this point as well, came from a series of Court of Appeals cases, which the term limits case, the Lehman v. Bradbury case, later struck down, where the court said, no, there's no implication. It's got to affect one way, shape, or form that particular amendment. And, of course, we get the Measure 7 decision, which I also haven't heard discussed at all, where the court said, by implication, Measure 7 somehow affected Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution. I totally disagree with the court's decision, but that's the decision. I think in the end, in legal circles, and especially in constitutional law circles, there's a famous decision, the Lochner decision, which is widely regarded as one of the three worst decisions ever handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court. I tend to think that the Armada decision is going to be the Oregon Supreme Court's Lochner decision eventually. The issue that HJR 29 addresses is what does that last sentence in Article 17, Section 1 mean? It clearly states, it doesn't say prohibit, it says impair. And the rule of law on constitutional construction is those words have meaning. They're there for a reason. We don't ignore them. Although, interestingly, to date, the Oregon Supreme Court has never answered the question, what does that last sentence mean? In the Armada decision, if you read it through, the court didn't get to it. The court stopped right before that sentence, analyzed Article 17, Section 1, and stopped. Never makes mention of the last sentence. In the term limits decision, I represented U.S. term limits in that case, we brought the same issue up, and Justice Gillette, during oral argument, outright told us that I'm not going to address that issue. We're not going to address that issue. HJR 29 says, the words mean what they say. The words mean what they say. This should not, the separate vote requirement should not be used to impair the right of the people to amend the Constitution by initiative. And I'll just conclude by saying this, and then I'll be happy to, after Steve and Dave are done, I'll be happy to answer questions. Right now, if anyone came to me and said, should I do this by statute or by amendment, I'm going to tell them statute every day of the week and twice on Sundays, because there's just no way you can satisfy Armada. No way. Because of the stretch, because of the grasp that Armada has on our process, it is impossible. Because anybody, any creative lawyer, and God knows there are millions of them out there, can come up with some creative argument to suggest that not only does this measure affect property rights, Article 1, Section 18 of our Constitution, but it also affects Article 1, Section 8, free speech rights, or Article 9 of our Constitution, finance. Can come up with any number of outlets for the court to decide, you know what, we don't like this measure, we're going to throw it out. The real tragedy here is that we have not addressed what that last sentence means. HJR 29 tells the court
this is what it means. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dahl.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dahl. I am president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. I want to thank you for hearing my testimony today and tell you what a pleasure it is to be in front of your committee, because I get very used to appearing before the judiciary, and that's the only committee I seem to ever get to see in this building. I'm not a lawyer. As my friend Mr. Fedanke said, he's not a lawyer, I'm not a lawyer. And I can't give you anywhere near a legalistic, nor will I attempt to, explanation of the whys and wherefores of Armada. I do have to say this, though, to my friend Mr. Fedanke. I would no more call him a so-called legal expert than I would my mother by her first name. And I object to them calling the Measure 40 a so-called crime victims bill. It's derisive and it's disrespectful. And to show you how political this issue is, the ACLU and the Criminal Defense Bar also opposed Measure 40 when it was divided into seven parts as it approached the voters in the special election in fall of 1999. And at that time, even when it was split up, they still referred to it as so-called crime victims bills. So I really have to put that on the record. Representative Mona Anderson asked the key question here, though, today. She said, why? Why did this happen? And what I would submit to you is the reason this happened was not because of Measure 40, but because it disturbed the legal elite in this state so badly. The legal elite who controls the state bar, who is, my friends here will tell you, who are both attorneys. The state bar is not controlled by tax attorneys. It's not controlled by plaintiff's attorneys or business attorneys or family lawyers. It's controlled by criminal defense attorneys. And I can tell you that Measure 40 drove them absolutely wild. If you read Measure 40, and I would encourage you to do it, I've got it here myself and I just reread it today, there's nothing confusing about Measure 40 or what it does. I can guarantee you the voters were not confused by this document. The Armada decision was nothing more or less than a political hijacking of our Constitution to diminish and impede the right of the people to the initiative process. What I would ask you is this: it took them 92 years. As I think Ms. Olney testified to, the section on amending was brought in 1906, so it took them until 1998, 92 years, to get to this decision. Now, that should pose to you the question that I'm posing, is that this is about politics. It's not about the law. If you look in Measure 40, and I have to tell you, I've been involved in 13 different ballot measures since I've been involved in the political process. I've won 9 and I've lost 4. I'm going to shut down my testimony because I know you're constrained by time, but I think here's something that you should know. Measure 22 was brought this last election to district the appellate courts in the state of Oregon. In the original Constitution, the courts were districted. That measure lost by 0.4 points. And in fact, if you pull Multnomah County out of the mix, we won 32 of 34 counties. If you pull Multnomah County out of the mix, we passed it by 35,000 votes. The point is this: if you want to know how political this process is, I had someone in the legal community, actually someone on the court, come to me and have lunch with me 2 weeks before the election and basically tell me in very cryptic legalistic language that if you do pass Measure 22, we will throw it out and we will use our surrogates in the defense bar and the ACLU to bring a case and get it thrown out. Now that's because I guess the voters in this state are too stupid to figure out the difference between the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court when we say appellate courts. I'll end my testimony with that, but I hope you understand that this was a political land grab, a political hijacking of our right, the initiative process, and thank you for taking my testimony.
Thank you. And not to encourage too long a testimony, but we actually are scheduled here till 3:30 before the next committee comes in, but Mr. Honeycutt, you are last, so I'm not giving permission to continue for half an hour, but you know, to respond to Mr. Dole's concern about time constraints.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt. I have, since Mr. Day has spoken for Oregonians in Action, I'll just speak as a private citizen. I hadn't planned on speaking today. But every time we discuss this subject, it makes me so angry and frustrated that I want to share some points with you so that you can understand what essentially is what's happened to the people's right to amend their own constitution. And I think that's the thing that we need to understand first and foremost. This is the people's constitution. It's not the legislature's constitution. It's not the Oregon Supreme Court's constitution, as much as they'd like it to be. It is the people's constitution. It's our document, and if we want to amend our document, we ought to be able to do that. To respond very briefly to Representative Backlund's point, I would agree with you. The Oregon Constitution is exceedingly long, and in many cases there are provisions in the Oregon Constitution that would adequately fit within the Oregon Revised Statutes and probably would be better if placed into the Oregon Revised Statutes as opposed to the Oregon Constitution. I would point out, however, that the vast majority of provisions that have been adopted by the people and placed into the Oregon Constitution since the initiative system was created in the early 1900s have been referrals by the Oregon legislature. So if we have a problem with, quote, constitutional clutter, unquote, I would say that we look to the Oregon legislature for that constitutional clutter as opposed to the people via the initiative process. Now, the problems that have been wrought by the Armada decision, I think Mr. Day touched on them very briefly, but I think they need to be explained in more detail. What the court said in Armada, and they were going back, again, as Mr. Dole pointed out, the separate votes provisions of the Oregon Constitution had been in place for 92 years before the Oregon Court of Appeals came along in the Armada decision and said that, oh, by the way, here's what the separate votes provisions mean. There had been essentially 92 years worth of constitutional amendments that had never been challenged. But what the court said in the Armada decision is if an initiative, whether it's referred to the legislature or by the legislature and approved by the people, or whether it's initiated by the people and then approved by the people, if an initiative violates the separate votes provisions of Article 17, Section 1, that initiative is void. It's not voidable. It is void, which means if the voters approved, if an initiative violates Armada and is, a constitutional amendment violates Armada, it's as if it doesn't exist. It's not part of the Constitution. So essentially, the crisis that the Supreme Court created with the Armada decision is the 92 years worth of amendments that the voters had approved, which, if challenged, since it's void, since they are void on their face, there's no statute of limitations. It's void. It's not part of the Constitution. One could go in with a lawsuit and challenge these various initiatives that the people have adopted over the previous 92 years, and those measures would then be essentially declared by a court of law to be unconstitutional. So you go back and you look over the course of the 92 years, what have the people put into the Constitution? And you see things, and I think the most glaring example are the amendments to Article 7, which Representative Flores asked about, the amendments to Article 7, which amended the judiciary section of the Oregon Constitution and essentially authorized the legislature to create the Oregon Court of Appeals. The amendments to Article 7 were put into the Constitution in 1910, after 4 years after the separate vote provision had been put into the Constitution. The amendments to Article 7 in that one initiative, it made 15 separate changes to the Constitution in one initiative. And if somebody came along at some point, they could do it today, they could do it a year from now, they could do it 10 years from now, somebody came along and challenged the amendments to Article 7 and said, look, the Oregon Court of Appeals doesn't exist because it couldn't exist without the amendments to Article 7, and the amendments to Article 7, which were adopted 93 years ago, were adopted in violation of Armada because the people were asked to vote for 15 different things on one initiative, then out the door the Court of Appeals would go because there would be no constitutional authority for the legislature to create the Court of Appeals. And so the constitutional mischief that could occur as a result of the Armada decision is huge. Now, we can all assume that the Oregon Supreme Court most likely wouldn't invalidate the Oregon Court of Appeals, and yet if you follow the Armada decision, that's exactly what they'd have to do, and the only way they could get out of that is essentially by making a political decision that doesn't extend Armada as far as they did in order to knock out Measure 40 and Measure 7 and all of the various other measures that they've adopted. So the Oregon Supreme Court has essentially put itself into a political box where they're going to be forced in order to get around the real impact of their Armada decision to scale back on that decision in a way that doesn't make any sense and is inconsistent with the Armada decision itself. So essentially, what we have is the Oregon Supreme Court playing politics, and I don't say that lightly. I took the oath to uphold the Constitution when I was when I passed the bar exam and was sworn in as a lawyer in this state, and all of the Supreme Court justices did at the same time. And I have the utmost respect for the judiciary branch. At the same time, as Mr. Day said, the Armada decision is going to turn out to be the Oregon Supreme Court's Lochner. It is far and away, in my opinion, the worst decision by the Oregon Supreme Court. And if somebody forces them to apply it literally, it will create a constitutional crisis in this state. H.J.R. 29 goes back and essentially unrings the bell. It makes sure that the existing language in the Oregon Constitution means what it says. It's a measure that ought to be supported by this body, and it's a measure. And we would ask that this committee and of course the House and the Senate say to the Oregon Supreme Court, the Constitution belongs to the people and not just to you. So we'd support. I strongly support H.J.R. 29, and would ask you folks to do the same.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And saying that was all we had to testify on this bill, so we will close the public hearing on HJR 29. And without any further business before the committee, we are adjourned.